A passage here from Nicholas Pajayev for comment. Memory and oblivion alternate in human life. I forget many things for a time. Many things disappear from my consciousness and are yet preserved at a deeper level. Oblivion has always been a source of profound disquiet to me. I have sometimes forgotten not only significant events, but even people who have played a great part in my life. I always regarded this as a failing and a kind of betrayal. There is a life-giving power in memory. Memory seeks to conquer death. Nice passage. Is this memory the one that conquers death? What we mean by consciousness? Let's have a look at this in terms of our primary geometry of motion. We've defined memory before as substantial motions differentiating and being affirmed. The substance itself and its circumscribing limit, the differentiation of the form within it, and the affirmation of those forms. All this constitutes memory. Remembering is making again a member of a whole. Memory in itself is the affirmation of the differentiations of the zone of substance. Now, consciousness is that in which memory elements are presented, that in which any element whatever of which we are aware is presented. Vajayap here is saying that he feels uncomfortable about the fact that sometimes memory fails. And then he feels he's betraying. He's betraying his relation with people. He's betraying people who have helped him. He's betraying himself if he lapses from memory. That is, if elements of his experience disappear from him, they're out of his control. And if he has in the past valued these things, said they are worth remembering, and then they lapse without his deliberately suppressing them, then he feels he has betrayed something or someone, either himself or somebody else. Let's take the O in memory for a moment. That's the limiting factor. Let's put the substance in and the opposition of this substance. The two ends vibrating within. And the R, which is the rippling forms running through every point of interrelation of forces. Where two forces cross, we always get interference. And the interference always generates a vortical spin or circumscribes. So every time we make two forces cross, we get a rotation of force at that point. Now these rotations are the elements of memory. When this memory differentiates adequately, the R function, when it differentiates adequately, that are presented in the field of consciousness of the being, all the things it has ever known. And when these things are presented, then that being can act adequately. He can act efficiently within an environment that bears relations to the past environments he's been in. Now what actually happens in the case of a lapse of memory? We know this, that every being retains in itself, like the irritable substance we call protoplasm, the after motions of the original stimulus. There is a being, we'll pretend for a moment that this being can exist without any internal motion. This is not true. It is an abstraction to oversimplify the situation so that we can consider it. We'll pretend there is a being that is perfectly empty. This is the famous tabula rasa, the blank tablet of the scholastics. It never existed. It is inconceivable that it should exist. And nevertheless, for the sake of this discussion, we are pretending for a moment that it can exist. There is a perfectly blank piece of protoplasm. Then we apply the energy of a stimulus. This causes a ripple. And as we've said before, the ripple in a simple piece of protoplasm goes right through the whole protoplasm and is reflected back to the source of the stimulus and carries on reverberating within that protoplasm. And that kind of uninterrupted total response we call protopathic response, the first feeling response. Total response. Now that formal vibration, viewed as something upon which we can call, is then the memory of this being. Now how does it happen that this memory can lapse? Because the memory is the formal vibrations of the substance, and those vibrations can never cease within that being. So what is the meaning of the loss of memory? As the vibrations are always there, what does it mean to say that we can forget something? It means quite simply that somehow we are able to set up zones of influence surrounding the wall of force in such a way that we can stop the motions of the substance entering into that zone. Somehow we might be able to clear a zone relatively of the motion of the whole protoplasm. Now, in fact, we can never eliminate it completely, because the whole protoplasm is a whole protoplasm, and the stimulation of any part is the stimulation of all. So it means to say that where there is a lapse of memory, the lapse is only relative. There is a deliberate will to stop certain characteristic vibrations from continuing. They cannot be eliminated, but by deliberate counter-contractions of the protoplasm, they can be reduced. Imagine for a moment here is a wave in the protoplasm. And the protoplasm is able to move in response to a stimulus. Let's pretend this is the protoplasm itself, a section through it, and there is a wave. That wave is memory. Now the protoplasm, in its adjustment to a stimulus, has created that wave. Supposing it doesn't like that wave, well, simply it expands itself in one place and contracts itself in another. It forces the top of the wave down and the bottom of the wave up. This means that it has the power to reduce the amplitude of the wave inside itself. Now, if at the same time it deliberately steps up some other kind of motion, so that relatively there's a very great intensity of the motion B and a very low intensity of the motion A, then the being will be more aware of B than of A. Now, A can never cease, but it can be suppressed. The amplitude of the wave can be cut down, but it cannot be eliminated completely. Now, why does protoplasm do this on itself? Why does it suppress elements of its experience? And the answer is, of course, this mysterious word pain. Pain is the place of refusal. The aim in it means the refusal, the negation of the energy. A very painful stimulus has come to this being and started a very powerful ripple. And the being doesn't like this ripple. So it brings pressure to bear on it to force it down as low as it possibly can get it. It will always be there in some degree. But it's going to force it down, and when it's reduced it to the lowest level possible, we then say it has gone into the unconscious. And psychological parlance is a tendency to talk as if the unconscious were a place. It isn't a place, except in this sense, that a wave of large amplitude occupies more space than a wave of small amplitude. A very big wave is covering more space in its oscillations than a small wave. And it's only in that sense that the unconscious occupies a place. The unconscious is equally distributed throughout the whole of the approach pattern. So the wave really goes all the way through and back again to the point and spreads out through the whole approach pattern. But to clarify this, we can do another diagram. Remember that the action band created by force going in cannot go to the dead center, and that in the center there is a wall of energy. That energy is rotating so fast that no external stimulus can get into it. But when an external stimulus comes of a painful order, the energy that is coming in is too great to be assimilated. Because it is too great to be assimilated, therefore it is called pain. It is refused. And the protoplasm tries to stop it spreading. And it just batters it with its own energy from inside to isolate that zone of pain. Now, if it presses very hard at the right frequency, it can cause that pain to lapse from consciousness. Now, although it has lapsed from consciousness, it is still there. This wall of energy around it is stopping its spreading, but the wall itself is vibrating, and therefore going through the tissue there is a ghost of this pain, the shadow pain, as it's called. This shadow pain, this ghost of a pain, is simply the product of the vibration of the wall of energy surrounding a zone of pain. And we call this zone of pain an engram. And the engram is simply a formal pattern emotionally charged with the memory of pain. And we don't want to know about it. Now, supposing a man is subjected to many such pains, supposing one very, very strong pain hits on this center fiery band, can't penetrate through it. But it does manage to get that far before the energies of the protoplasm succeed in warming it in. We now have a big zone there of pain in the person, a lapse of the memory. At this moment, the relative shape of the consciousness of this being is like this. I'll abstract it. That's the shape of this being as it feels itself to be consciously. One day another pain comes to it, and this spreads out. This will impinge on the band of another pain and perhaps on the middle. And you can see immediately that the shape of this being consciously is now like this. Now you see that being has two bits of consciousness. That being is now technically a schizophrene. There are zones of unconsciousness here that he knows nothing about. If we send it into another painful stimulus on the other side, and this is very strong, penetrates to the middle, we reduce him to a shape something like this. A little bit on the edge there. And then a thin bit here. He's now a schizophrene with three personalities. Still hidden inside his substance are the painful experiences that have cut him into bits. They're still there, and because they're still there, it's possible to recover this man and remake him whole. If they really didn't exist, it's a protoplasm that had the power to throw them away absolutely. You couldn't cure him, because there wouldn't be a him to cure. There would be three hymns, and cure would be impossible. The fact that those pain zones still exist inside him is the possibility of his re-entering the whole state again. Now, he does not remember whole zones of his experience. When Berdyaev says here, "I feel that I'm betrayed," he means he should be a whole man, and he should be in whole relationship with another man. But if in fact, through the lapse of memory, caused by painful experiences, unassimilated, and through this, he's not a whole man, but he's several bits of men, like we're expecting Ber and Jayev, this differentiating process. He is betraying himself because he should be a whole man. And in betraying himself, he's betraying other beings, because he cannot wholly relate himself unless he's whole. Now, how do we recover zones of unconsciousness inside ourselves if, when we come to think consciously, we're deprived of the necessary data of the contents of those painful zones? No matter how hard we try to think in a conscious zone, that conscious zone has no data in it that can release the painful formal content of a pain zone. These pain zones are the repression zones of ordinary psychology. There is only one possible way for such a zone to be cleared, and that is by consciously taking your initiative into the pain, that is, running into the painful thing inside oneself. We can feel zones of sensitivity, zones of pain inside ourselves, and we tend to run away from them. If we do run away from them, we can never become whole. Somehow we've got to learn to face positively the thing inside ourselves that we don't want to face. When we say we don't want to face it, we're saying this: a man may think he's this shape, and there's a whole area of his being unknown. So when he says, "I must face my unconscious," he's identified with the conscious piece of himself, and he's misusing the term "I." Now, if he remembers that the observer is not the observed, and that the immanent spirit, or the inner self, is the real "I," then that "I" is not identified with the conscious elements, unrepressed, but it is identified with pure consciousness itself. And the question says here, is this memory, the memory referred to by Berdyaev, the one that conquers death, what we mean by consciousness? Well, by consciousness, we are referring to the paper. And by memory, the marks made upon the paper, considered as existing patterns of vibrations upon which we can call. So the consciousness is not the memory, but the memory is the totality of objects to be presented in the consciousness. If we don't have anything to remember, consciousness has nothing to strike against, and therefore is non-objective. If we have the paper with no drawing on, then the paper does not know that it is a paper. It only knows that it's a paper if we do a drawing on it. Consciousness knows itself as consciousness consciously only by putting an object and bouncing against it, feeling the resistance. Resistance is an essential part of self-consciousness. Here we get again a positive value for the individual. The finite individual is a resistance inserted into an infinite field of awareness. Without that resistance, there would be infinite awareness, but the infinite awareness would be merely infinite, that is to say, not finite, that is to say, non-objectified, that is to say, valueless. As far as we're concerned, it would be as if it were not. It would be like a not awareness. And it has been so called by some of the mystics. It's a non-knowing, it's an unknowing. and knowing of a non-objective state, but it isn't a reflexive knowing, because reflexive knowing is the knowing one gets when one bends back and meets oneself in resistance, as when you close your hand and grip your fingers against your palm and your thumb over your fingers. As you do this process of self-gripping, you become objectified and aware of yourself very sharply. If you relax totally, you become less aware of yourself objectively, and if you're not careful, you will lapse into sleep. If you're even careless in sleep, you may lapse into nirvana, in which case, as an individual, you would not subsist. You would be not qualified to be an occidental representative man. The function of the finite object is to provide a resistance so that one can discover the actual powers of consciousness itself. Burmese, which is a funny word, Gegenwurf. Now, Gegen is against, and this Wurf is from werfen, to throw. It's usually translated counterstroke, but really it means something thrown against. And if you throw yourself against a wall in order to see how much force you have, if you throw yourself against a piece of tissue paper stretched over a hoop, you go through very easily. If you put a drum skin on, you go through less easily. If you throw yourself at a solid piece of hardboard well nailed on a frame, you'll find it a little harder to get through, and you might lose your ears in the process. If you throw yourself at a mass of concrete, you will discover the limits of your individual power. And the object of throwing against, this is another word for devil, the diabolos, the object of it is to discover the possibilities of consciousness itself. It can only be done in opposition. Now, the Derf is feeling bad about the betrayal of oneself and others through the lapse of memory. But memory cannot lapse unless it is painful. Remember that the vibrations inside our substance are permanent. So lapse of memory cannot mean the absolute cessation of a vibration. It can only mean the repression of the vibration, the reduction of the amplitude of the wave, to get it down as near as possible to no wave. For it always is a wave. And that is all that lapse of memory means, the reduction of a wave of high amplitude, forcing it down as near to the straight line as possible. The sea looks very calm. But if you watch it very carefully, it isn't static. Something's going on there. And it's the same with this memory. Now, he thinks it's awful to betray, but he hasn't quite seen at this point in his evolution that betrayal is a phase that one must go through if one is to develop the potentialities of consciousness, because without the Gegenwurf, the resistance, one cannot discover one's whole nature properly. Supposing we have a zone of unconsciousness caused by pain, that is a lapse of the memory of a particular event and a particular relations with certain people. Supposing you overvalued a certain thing called X, and you were aware that the overvaluation of this thing was causing a disequilibrium in your whole being, it could then become painful for you to overvalue that thing, and you could decide to wall it from inside so that you forget that stressed value. You deliberately reject it because it's overvalued. You remember Nietzsche said, the trouble with great men is they fascinate. They can paralyze one's individual initiative. If a man is too great, if, say, God incarnates in Christ, if he were to show too much of his capacity too quickly without preparation, nobody dare move. If he did what he did on Job and showed him his right arm hast thou now my mind. Nobody will be prepared to oppose him and stand as a Gegenwurf for him, because they'd expect to get knocked down. So periodically, throughout life in its various phases, certain things have to be hidden. The energy inside has to suppress them so that one does not become fascinated by them. And then the conscious parts of the being, when they try to work a problem out, they initiate a motion in themselves. That motion goes to a limiting factor, but the limiting factor is the zone of pain into which they cannot enter. And they then bounce against that zone of pain and return the motion into the consciousness and generate another zone of formal content, which will lead to greater understanding later. So that between two pain zones, inside the conscious, certain energies are battered together and produce formal reverberations which ultimately enlighten that being in a way that he could not have been enlightened without those painful zones existing. So, in that sense, the betrayal of something, a favourite idea, the betrayal of oneself or of another person, is a phase to which one must go at some time in one's life. You see this in small boys who have friends. One boy might get a terrible attachment to another boy, and he can only play with that particular boy. He can't play with another boy. So he never knows what other boys are like, because he's busy playing with this boy. So gradually there builds up inside him an awareness that somehow this attachment is killing his development. And suddenly they have a tremendous quarrel. They don't know why, but it's a stored up energy from other parts of their being demanding that this relation be broken, because it is tyrannizing over the whole being. And so these very close friends have a terrible blow. And at this point they run away and find new friends. And if they didn't make that breakup, they couldn't find their new friends. And if they didn't find them, they wouldn't know much about the world. They'd only know something about their special relationship. They wouldn't be equipped to deal with other aspects of the world. So in this sense, the immanent spirit, the inner self, sends messages where the attachment is too great and breaks it down. You remember Abraham and Lot, their herdsmen quarrel over the question of feeding ground, pastures and water. And Abraham says to Lot, a man and his friend must part at this point. So now you choose. If you to the right, I to the left. If you to the left, I to the right. Lot makes a funny choice and gets into trouble. But the fact is they have to part. If Abraham and Lot had not parted, then later on Abraham would not have met a very important person in his career, because he wouldn't have had to chase about fighting a little war and trying to do a spot of rescue work, and therefore he would not have come into contact with an essential idea of his evolution. At some point, the Adamic egg has to cut itself in half. He has to take out his Eve and throw it away, and his Adam. And he has to turn them back on each other and have a fight, say harsh words. And suddenly lady knows and will say to her husband in private, sometimes this is necessary to be naughty. Because if there is no opposition and throwing mutually against each other, there can be no growth of understanding, no discovery of new levels of relation. But the whole thing would lapse into sleep. All you'd have for a picture of the universe would be a nice double settee with two shut eyes in it, holding hands. It looks very nice, and it's a sort of pipe dream for 20-year-olds, but it's no good. It's equivalent to lapsing back into the mud. And the deep inner self in each of them is resenting this. After a time, he feels the tips of her fingernails and thinks, she hasn't found those as carefully this week as she did last week, and so on, and he mentions it. This, of course, is the beginning of a deeper understanding. She then reveals a little firework that she'd been hiding, The shower's going to rain on me. Now, this is absolutely essential for individual development. So, the curious thing about Vijaya's betrayal idea is this. Correctly understood, a betrayal is a deliberate act of the inner self, not always, but frequently, a deliberate act of the inner self to liberate itself from a too great devotion on a part of one's being. Let's look at a couple of three-part beings now. There are two three-part beings. You can tell which is which, have joy. And there might be a tremendous preoccupation for a short period, and in this period, other parts of the being are complaining, and they're sending messages down like this. There are other things, you know, you haven't done your homework, and so on. These things gradually pile up, and then there's a cut-off. Suddenly, something happens. The thing won't work anymore. Whatever it is, it doesn't matter where you devote yourself to. If you devote yourself too long to one part of the being, you will saturate that part of the being and block it with the byproducts of activity, and then it can't function. And only when it can't function do you gain the opportunity for paying attention to some other parts of the being that have been neglected. And ultimately, as the Greek said, if you can pay the same amount of attention all over the being, then you will equilibrate. But the tendency is to go towards certain zones because they offer greater pleasure than other zones. This they do because nature has its own purpose within the individual purpose. The paper represents the pure consciousness. The vibrations in the paper represent the memory. So the consciousness is not the memory is not the consciousness. But the memory provides the formal content which consciousness perceives. And the consciousness is the guarantee that the vibrations of the memory shall be evaluated. To increase our awareness, we have to cut down on the zones of unconsciousness inside ourselves. As long as there is a zone of unconsciousness in us, caused initially by pain, we do not have the power to balance our whole being. A man who's been cut by painful stimuli into various beings, reduced to the level of perhaps a peculiar schizophrenia, shaped in this manner as we've just seen, that man cannot act wholly, cannot complete his evolution. Such a man must become dissatisfied with the parts of his consciousness that he has, and he will then betray them. Now, the betrayal of these conscious parts of the man who's been split by pain is an essential of his return to health. And this betrayal is what we call the neurotic or psychotic syndrome. There's a complex of symptoms running together, and they are his waking conscious contribution to his life. He's thinking in an erroneous, badly accented manner, and he doesn't like what he's thinking, and so he goes against it. He betrays it. Although it's him and his experience, he goes against it and he goes for help, for treatment, to regain his wholeness. The only way he can be made whole again is by restoring to him the unconscious parts, which are previous betrayals. Parts of himself that have been betrayed by the non-acceptance of painful situations. If we look at betrayal, we're merely saying that there is a law function there which has been broken. Two men agree on a certain proposition. Because they have agreed on this proposition, and are committed to it, they can trust each other because they have the same idea. Now, if one of the men now changes his idea without saying so, and goes away, the other man will say he has been betrayed. He's been betrayed because the partner has abandoned that to which he had declared himself attached. He has a symbol up here to symbolize the law, but A and B have agreed to observe this law. A goes away and forgets all about it, and B declares that A has betrayed their trust. But A had another reason for going away. He wasn't betraying the trust. He had noticed a peculiar thing about the law as defined to which A and B had committed themselves. And he had decided that that law was not adequately defined and was deficient in some way, not sufficient data. So he went away for further data. And his going away for him is not a betrayal of himself, but it is defined as a betrayal by his colleague. He's really been true to himself in betraying that deficient image. Like Francis Thompson said on one occasion about a certain religious organization, their treacherous trueness and their loyal deceit. He was referring to his co-religionists who were so busy being true to the dogmatic form that they allowed each other to starve. He was starving at the time he had the thought. He was looking for a higher concept. They were looking for a formal dogma and a ritual, a procedure to stick to, their security mechanism. He saw a higher truth and went to get it. They defined him as a bad member of their church. He saw through their devotion to the security ritual, saw in being true to their ritual, they were being untrue to the free spirit behind the ritual. He could see more than they could. Later on, of course, when he became a very famous accepted poet, then he was accepted, after death, of course, into the fold. Like many another force that is no longer a threat, it can be assimilated and given a crown. Most important of all is this fact, to remember. To remember is to make again a member. There is the man, the substance, there is the zone, the B, the limiting factor, and the R, the running about, differentiating. To turn this thing back on itself, to differentiate all the forces within this being continuously, is continuous remembrance. Now you remember in the Bhagavad Gita, it is defined worship is continual remembrance. If we forget the great principle, which principle I've just drawn, if we forget that principle and the continuously dynamic flow of spirit, at the moment of forgetting it, we betray it. We betray the whole when we are faithful to the part, to the exclusion of the whole. So if a man decides to concentrate on a given aspect of his being, in the act of concentrating on that part, if he concentrates on it believing it to be a supreme value, in itself he has betrayed his wholeness. But if he concentrates upon that thing in order to understand it, in order to bring it back into the whole, then he's not betrayed it. But another person on the outside, not understanding his purpose, would think he had betrayed himself by devoting himself to that particular. So in the field of science, one man might devote himself to trying to make a given thing, like Goodyear making rubber for tires and so on. While he's doing this, and before he succeeds, other people say he is betraying the trust his wife played in him. Placed in. He is getting on with a perfectly useless activity. If he manages to put the mixture in her oven and spoil her cake, every time he spoils the cake, he's betraying her and his promise to her. And then one day he puts it in the oven and spoils an ugly sponge cake and brings out a motor tire. And that's faith. Now he's no longer betrayed her. And so the question of what is and is not betrayal depends upon the purpose for which it's being done and whether ultimately it succeeds. The judge there is accusing himself of betraying because he can't remember. And he can't remember because pain has come to him and been rejected. And in rejecting the pain, he has rejected experience. And the symbol of Christianity, the symbol of the cross, means the acceptance of pain, the affirmation of a negation. It doesn't matter how painful that thing is. If you dare to run towards it and examine it as it comes in, you can assimilate it. And it is then not technically pain, because you're not refusing it, you're accepting it. And it does not feel the same if you accept it. You may have seen a child in the dentist's chair. Before it is touched, it is keyed up and screaming. It hasn't yet been touched. But it is rejecting the very idea of it. Now, if the dentist firmly and compassionately takes it by the throat and inserts the forceps, the child's whole condition of hypertension is such that it's going to be hurt far more than that it usually hurts them. If, on the other hand, it becomes possible to enlighten the child about the necessity of suffering certain orders of discomfort for higher orders of comfort, then the child may be opened up to accept these things. And in the moment of acceptance, a lot of tension that was concentrated in the zone is removed, and immediately the protoplasm there is able to assimilate the motion much more easily. So if you can consciously relax in a painful situation, the relaxation reduces the amount of pain. And if we can bring ourselves to total relaxation, then it comes to total annihilation of the pain. Because pain simply means a place of refusal. If then, when a painful stimulus comes and begins to spread through the organism, if we stop that pain spreading, because it's pain, we have betrayed our wholeness and betrayed our relationship to the universe, because we have refused something that the universe has offered. We don't like it. Christ is called all things to all men because he accepted all kinds of stimuli. And we can't expect a child initially to accept pain as it comes to it, because the child is echoing the evolution of the race, and the child is in a state of identification with its protoplasm. So that when a motion comes to it that is coming a little fast, difficult to assimilate, the child contracts to try to keep it out. And this contraction increases the pain. If we can gradually educate this child to accept pain and teach it to open itself to it, then it becomes less painful and the child becomes wiser and able to assimilate more of the universe. Imagine in the case of the space flyers, those men who would not like to submit to the process of training, hard training for space flight, will not be able to go on interplanetary journeys. They'll be as sick, relatively, as first timers on a Manx boat. No matter how small or how large the assimilation problem is, if you don't assimilate it, it means you cannot go in that zone. Someday, going from the Earth, human beings, some of them, those who face the pain, will be able to go quite comfortably tremendous distances. But only those who have faced the necessity of assimilating strange new stimuli will be able to get there. The others who don't face this problem of assimilation will have to stay where they are. And ultimately, every finite zone is taken to bits by the inevitable process of time. So if those beings, through refusing to face pain, have got themselves stuck in one position, when that position is taken to bits, as it is inevitably by cyclic law, they will suffer all the pains in the moment of that disintegration that they have avoided throughout the whole of their being. All these things add up. So the end result of this statement is, memory is the formal motions of the substance, consciousness is that in which these forms are presented and whereby we know that the forms exist. Painful zones are zones rejected. They have a positive use insofar as reflection between a pain zone and another zone causes differentiation of motion and therefore increase in knowledge. But if they remain merely negative and locked up permanently, the pain zones are a betrayal of the wholeness of the being. So we have to accept that there are painful zones for a time. Try to understand the meaning. Meaning is always between. What is the meaning of these two pains? And that which is between them, consciousness. Consciousness is stimulated by these two pain zones. It's made to think in ways it would not think without those pains. And to affirm the value of the thought process arising from the pains is to convert a negative into a positive. If we take all the walls down prematurely from all pains, the being will lapse into a state prior to the level it's aiming at. It will remain at a low level and will not attain maturity. Maturity is the state when the substance of that being has actually made itself into law. It's matura. It is the affirmation and the establishment of the law in that substance. And the law is a law of the assimilation of all possible stimuli. The being that can teach himself and have the courage to teach himself to absorb all stimuli of whatever character, that being is an immortal being. But the being who flinches from any given character of stimulus and rejects it cannot assimilate it. And in so doing, makes himself unwhole. And the part of himself where the division is going to split, and that is his mortality. So all rejected pain zones, if they're left permanently rejected, will guarantee the mortality of that being, because they will split off. And all pain zones assimilated in their due time, not prematurely, all pain zones assimilated are a restatement of a wholeness, but at a higher level than the original wholeness you had before the pain. Your whole state before you have any pain is the state of a being with a flux of motion in it, but with no tension in it and no objective consciousness. We have already falsified it by drawing a circle. I've drawn the circle there to locate the being. I've made it abstract by drawing nothing on the inside. That being is a unity prior to analysis, a pre-analytic unity. It is a unity but a very low order and quite useless. And if we put inside this unity a force that spins round and characterizes it, its value increases. And this becomes not an abstract idea, but a fact. This diagram now represents a being with characteristic motions, geometrizing and illuminating it and filling it with formal understanding. But unless it gets a resistance, all this formal understanding will be at the same level It will be like living in a field of Platonic ideas with no superstresses. So you will know everything at the same level of intensity. You will know nothing more clearly than you know everything else, which is equivalent to not knowing anything very well. Everything is stressed in exactly the same way, and consequently it is as if there were no stress. So you need the Gegenwart, if you need something throwing at you to hit you. And then the characteristic stimulus here causes a reverberation within your being, and according to the nature of that stimulus, it sets up certain superstresses inside the being and draws a form. It doesn't draw a form that isn't there, but it superstresses one that is there and makes you very sharply conscious of the fact that you knew something but didn't know that you knew it. Everybody's had this experience. There's something there in the mind, they know what it is, they can't quite localize it, and then suddenly something hits them and they say, ah, that's it. I knew it was that thing. Now, we know everything prior to the analytical process. We know all, but with the aid of stimuli coming and hitting us, we are allowed to build up certain formal patterns in ourselves by superstress and become aware not only of all, but of each. And then to relate all these eaches within, wherever they are, and increase our understanding. When the whole process is completed, looking backwards from that moment, it is seen that there has been no betrayal. But until the whole process is completed, you can say there is still some betrayal left, either of the whole by the part, or of the part by the concept of the whole not yet reached.
To relax in a painful situation, one can say the observer is not the observer. There is anything else that one can do.
Yes, you can think about the meaning of that fact and add to it, not merely the verbal statement, the observer is not the observer, but add to it this fact. The paper is the observer only when he serves an arm. And if he doesn't move, he hasn't made a form. If he does move, he makes a form. I'll draw a circle to represent the movement of the paper. That movement is an object, but the object is of the subject. It is not the subject, but it is of the subject. It is a self-motion that brings that object into being. The motion is the object. Now, the observer presupposes that the object has been made. It is not a server of unless it has made of. So if the paper does not vibrate at all, then there is no object. And the paper is then not an observer. It is serving nothing at all. But as soon as it begins to move, it is then an observer because it is serving an object. When you know that fact, you know that as soon as you begin to move, you have objectified. This means as soon as you define, even verbally, a situation, you have objectified. But as soon as you objectify, you cause a Gegenwart, you cause a diabolic throw against your being. You cause a threat because you have defined. Now you remember in the short talk we had about the fool in the tower on one occasion, we talked about his refusal of definitions. The fool, for Christ's sake, is the man who goes to all situations without defining them. He's just busy accepting them all and going through them, but he's not saying what it is he is accepting, because if he did so, he would objectify it. There he is, walking up over the edge of the precipice, carelessly, and you say to him, you are walking over the edge of a precipice, and he says, what is a precipice? What is walking over? There's a little doggy jumping at his feet here, and you say, is the dog biting you, or is it your dog going with you, and is he trying to warn you? He says, I don't know. He may be wanting a bone. He may be wanting to warn me. He may be wanting to bite me. Maybe he wants me to pass him. I don't know. I don't define. And because he doesn't define it, it can have no effect on him. He walks about in the realm of the beast, that is the state, and he cannot read the definitions. He can't fill in a form. He can't even read his own name. He doesn't know it's for him. He gives it to the Irish woman next door and she fills it in. By this continuous conscious process of the refusal of a definition, he refuses objectification. And in refusing objectification, he escapes the consequences of objectification. He's a level of awareness, therefore, that is transcendent of the objectifying level. But the objectifying level exists below him, and in the figure of the chariot, the driver in the chariot, you have another kind of individual, not the one that refuses definition, the one that drives through definitions as he sees them. He has seen them, but he's going to go through them. He does see the policeman on the gate, and he goes through the policeman on the gate, kissing him fondly on the helmet as he goes by. This man is totally different from the fool, and all these subsets coexist inside every individual. You have a very, very high level which refuses definition. This is the fool level, and it corresponds with the non-dualist level of the Advaita Shankara philosophy. He says all definitions are nothing. They are negatives, and therefore I walk about regardless. But another being, like the hermit, is going along with his light, discovering himself. And he's defined the self to discover it. And another being, the emperor in us, is busy ruling the material world that we have to rule in coming into contact with it at all. All these are different levels of the same being. In relation to avoidance of pain, the fool is the best friend. You remember Socrates saying, what is good, what is bad? Is it bad to be sick? Yes. So you're sick in bed and you can't go yachting with your two friends and they go alone. Is that bad? Yes, that's bad. Your two friends drown at sea and you're still in bed ill. Is that good or bad? Oh, that's good. Now you can't tell unless you define. So the fool is beyond good and evil because he refuses to define. And his refusal to define makes him transcendent of every situation. A lady rolls her eyes at him. He doesn't even know it's a lady. Consequently, he can't get into trouble. Whatever he gets into, it isn't trouble because he never noticed the definition. So there's no control whatever over him by definitional entities. And so nobody can say a word about him other than that he's a fool. And if you say he's one of those beings that blows through the pea and escapes beyond the punctuated, the punctilious and the positive into the infinite. But he's only a top level awareness inside every being. Most people focus down below on the significance of another card called sometimes the devil and sometimes marriage. You remember the card where there's a man and a woman chained together and the chain goes through a ring in a large block of stone on which the devil sits in all his glory. That's another level of the same being. All these beings stand one above the other in a special order. But this fool is a supreme figure of indefinition, refusal of objectification. The hanged man is the same man at another level. He's the man that accepts the fact that he is crucified by him, by his will, his activity. But the whole man knows that he's a fool, and that he's a hanged man, a self-hanged man, and that he's an emperor, and the grand hierarch as well. The whole man contains all these levels of being symbolized in those cards, but the supreme one that releases all of them is the fool, because ultimately all the definitions have to be rubbed out in order to attain the freedom of spirit. So when you say the observer is not the observed, remember that the observer is only not the observed when he's not serving an ob. Not to serve an ob is the same thing as to refuse to define the situation in which you are. And whilst you're refusing in feeling to define this thing, at another level of your being, you can watch and define it. You can sit in the dentist chair if you like, and you can be transcendent of all definition at one level, and at the same time you can listen to the buzzing of the drill with another level, using the intellectual level to get the actual sounds and the sense stimuli without the rejection that causes the pain. So when you recite the observers, not the observed, do not allow it to degenerate into a ritual. Don't let it come down to the point where constant stimulation is equal to nerve stimulation. Don't let it be a merely verbal thing. Every time you use it, feed into it some more thought so that you understand it better and better and better. The observer is only an observer when he's serving an ob. When the paper is not vibrating, it is not an observer. When it vibrates, because it is the cause of the vibration, it is serving that vibration. It is the cause, and therefore it can stop causing. It can just make itself lie down. That's the kralaya, the lying down stage. And when it makes itself lie down, it's inhibiting, it's reduced the amplitude of those waves down nearly to zero. And the whole universe, for it, ceases to exist. But it is inhibiting it. As soon as it removes this inhibiting force, the universe bounces into existence again, presents it as an object, and it is then an observer. You may remember the argument between Brahma and Vishnu on one occasion about who is the greater. And Brahma is creator of the material world, and Vishnu is like the life in that world. And while they're arguing, suddenly a big column of fire and light comes, and it goes right up and right down, and Brahma decides to go to see where it goes to the top, Vishnu goes down to see where it goes to the bottom, and they can't find these limits, and they come back and say what a marvelous thing it is, and suddenly out of this column steps Shiva. Shiva is the other person of the Trinity. And he said, well, you two were arguing. He said, I was making this column. He represents that tremendous power of concentrated will. Brahma is creating the material world. Vishnu is being a life process within it. But Shiva has the power, by concentrating his attention, of folding the whole thing up. And because he can fold it up, he is called the destroyer. He destroys phenomena by simply folding it into a little spot in the centre of his intelligence, the bindu, the seed of the whole universe, one positive point, all motion is propagation from place to place. So as a line is simply a point moving, and the plane is that line moving, and the three-dimensional form, the cube, is that plane moving at right angles to itself. All depends on the point. But a point in geometry, as you know, is a location without dimensions. It's infinitely small, infinitely large. And therefore, in that point, is embraced the line, the plane, and the volume. So Shiva, who has this power to concentrate into a point, can reduce the whole phenomenal play of definitions to one definition. And this one definition is simply, it is a point moving, which I make. And he suppresses or destroys phenomena in that act. And when he's made that point, he's controlled everything. And at this point, if he wishes, he can give way to the fool, who looks at it and doesn't even know that it's a point. And thus escapes even the concentrated level. And this, of course, is paradoxical, to be able to concentrate on a point without phenomena disappearing, and yet somehow there aren't any phenomena at all, and you're walking through them. That's the highest grade of fool. That's one stage beyond zero.